Welcome, everybody, to another episode of The Interventional Endoscopist. I'm your host, Dr. Mankavul Sachdev, and today I'm going to talk about a new procedure, or a newer procedure, for many interventional endoscopists in the United States. Today we're going to talk just briefly about portal pressure measurements, or PPG, also known as EUS PPG, and kind of just my basic thing that I like to talk about is the procedure and how you get a program started, what you need, and why should we do it, etc. So first of all, I'm going to start off by talking about just portal pressure measurement in general. So portal pressure measurements have historically been done through the transjugular approach. It's very useful in the workup of liver diseases. Anytime that one suspects that a patient might have portal hypertension, or they have a known risk factor for portal hypertension, this can be a useful study. When we talk about transjugular approaches, we want to, or any portal pressure measurement, we want to look at the hepatic venous pressure gradient, also known as HVPG. And it can be used to aid in the management of people who are, on non-selective beta blockers as part of the treatment. So, in essence, you could see if those non-selective beta blockers are working by doing portal pressure measurements. And generally, when you have a gradient greater than 6 millimeters of mercury, that's when you start to see some clinically significant findings. That's when you start to notice portal hypertension. It's actually clinically significant when it's over 10 millimeters mercury. And the teaching is that when the HVPG is greater than 12 millimeters of mercury, that is when the risk for variceal bleeding is the highest. And the gradient is best determined as an indirect measurement. So what happens here is that you have to get two wedge pressures. You have to get the free hepatic venous pressure and a wedged hepatic venous pressure. And then you calculate the gradient by subtracting the venous pressure from the wedge hepatic venous pressure. And so the way that this is done is that a balloon-tipped catheter is put through the right jugular vein, generally done by interventional radiology under ultrasound guidance. And then they advance that catheter through the vein into the right atrium, and then ultimately into the IVC, and then into the right hepatic vein. And the entire time they're using fluoroscopy to help them get there. They do need to use contrast, so there is a relative contraindication of using this method in people who have iodine or shellfish allergies. But it's a relatively safe procedure, it's well tolerated, and a lot of interventional radiologists are really good at it. And they can actually also get liver biopsies at the same time. Oftentimes, when I was in my liver transplant fellowship, that was a safer way. The transjugular approach to do a liver biopsy was definitely safer than doing percutaneous in a lot of our cirrhotic patients with high INRs. And so we were doing workups for liver transplant, and we'd need to get the liver biopsy. And a lot of times the request would also be, well, since you're doing that, can you get us, hepatic venous, HVPG gradient, or, help us get the measurements. They would oblige and do it. For most interventional radiologists who are well-trained, this is not a super complicated or difficult procedure, but it is carries some risk, especially when you're talking about using radiation or iodinated contrast, et cetera. And also, the patient, you're going through their neck and then floating a catheter through their heart, which to me, as a non-interventional radiologist, or a non-radiologist, I should say, scares me a little bit. But so over the last few years, a new technique has started to develop. And in the first reference to EUS guided portal pressure measurements that I found was in 2016 in a video by somebody I have a lot of respect for, Dr. Ken Chang and his team, including Dr. Sam Racina, who's one of the experts in this procedure as well around the United States right now. Amongst a few other people. And I apologize if I fail to mention your name and, you know, you're listening to this podcast, but there's no disrespect intended if I forget your name. But this technique came out in 2016. It was an article presented in Video GIE. And in the description of the podcast, I'll have a link to that video so that if anyone's interested in watching the original, they can. It's actually very helpful in terms of learning how to set up the device that they are talking about. There's been some changes to it in the last 7 years, but definitely the concepts are the same. And so they described this technique using a 25-gauge fine needle aspirate needle. This particular one that they used was made by Cook Endoscopy, and it comes in its packaging with a compact manometer. And yeah, there's also a non-compressible plastic tubing, and there's the use of heparinized saline. So there's a whole setup and a way to put the needle together that you have to follow it to a T, otherwise the process doesn't work well. You also have to really make sure that you're putting your manometer or your measuring devices at the mid-axillary line of the patient with them lying as supine as possible. So, you know, there are some nuances to how you do the measurement that you really have to talk about. And we'll get a little bit into that when we talk about the technique, just a little bit. But and they did this initially on a porcine model. They were able to show that it was useful. They were able to show that it was safe in pigs. And then they did a human study that initially had about 28 patients in it. And they achieved pressure measurements that were successful in all 28 patients. And later on, they updated it a few years later to 51 patients. So the method of doing this procedure is pretty interesting, actually. So it's basically a endoscopic ultrasound. You bring the patient in, you have them in the supine position. You have to really follow the steps. And there's several videos online, which I'll try to, like I said, I'll link to the original video, and I'll look for some maybe industry-sponsored ones to put in the description of this podcast for you to kind of understand how, again, to set up the needle. And the first time I did it, my rep was there and he helped me. The second time I did it without the rep, I got a little bit of a ego boost and said, hey, I can do this, and I totally screwed it up. So, you know, you definitely, I mean, I didn't irreparably screw it up. I just, you know, it wasn't working initially. Then we realized why. So make sure you follow the steps to a T, and they have them written out in the instruction booklet with the needle, but I would just review some of these videos beforehand and just watch somebody else do it, especially if it's Dr. Chang and his team. But, you get the patient in the room, you're going to do an EUS, and then what you want to do is find the middle hepatic vein. And again, using some of these videos down there, you'll be able to see exactly where, but you're looking for the, what I like to call the elephant trunk. And it's just showing where, on the, when you go under the diaphragm, left lobe of the liver, and you'll see this elephant appearance or elephant trunk appearance. And then you're going to put the needle, 25 gauge needle into the vein, middle hepatic vein, and you're going to push just a small amount of heparinized saline out just so that you can see some bubbles form in the vein, or maybe not necessarily and echo bubbles, but they're not necessarily actually air bubbles because you don't want any air in there. But what you're seeing is just a little bit of flow. And if you do FNA or pancreatic cysts, and you've seen this happen before, that when the needle gets in there, sometimes you'll see a little flash of almost like waves or ripple currents or whatnot. So you'll see that in the vein. And then you have to stay there for about 30 seconds to a minute. Generally 60 seconds is better. And you'll get different measurements. And initially that portal pressure, that venous pressure will be very high. It might be 25 to even 60 millimeters mercury. But as you sit there for a minute and you kind of keep that needle still, and that's the really important thing is to keep it still, you'll start to see the number come down and it settle. And then you'll record it, and then you want to squirt in a little bit more of that saline, heparinized saline, and then get a second measure, and then ultimately a third. And then what you're going to do is after you take that out, you're going to take the needle out slowly. And many experts recommend doing kind of a zigzag removal approach. Now it is a 25 gauge needle, so the risk of bleeding is low, but you do want to have the Doppler on the needle tracked as you're pulling it out. And what I mean by zigzag is you'll pull it out maybe a centimeter, and then you might just change your angle slightly and pull it up. So you're almost creating like this virtual stair step or virtual zigzag line, so that in the event there is a small amount of bleeding that goes from the vein into the liver parenchyma, it's not a straight track out to the capsule. It's, you know, kind of a crooked line that has turns and twists in it so that clot can form and it can, you know. And you remember, if you have these patients who are portal hypertensive, many of them may have elevated INRs. And one can argue that if you already have an elevated INR, low platelets and varices, do you really need to do a portal pressure measurement? And if you're doing it to see if beta blocker doses are right, then that's one discussion. But, you know, you may not be doing this study in people who are clearly cirrhotic, but you definitely want to decrease the risk as much as possible. And then you're going to go and find the portal vein and do it as in there as well. And you're going to subtract the two numbers, and you're going to follow the same technique for the next one, where you measure three times. And what you'll do for both sets of measurements, even though it's three, you'll take the average. So if it's 11, 12, 12, it'll be, now I put myself in trouble here with math. It'll be 24 plus 11, divided, which is 35 divided by three. It'd be like, 11.7 or 11.5 or something like that. So anyway, you're going to take the average of the three numbers, and that's probably the smarter way to say it. You'll take the average of the three numbers, and then you'll subtract portal from the hepatic, and then that'll be your gradient. Now, currently in the United States, there is only one FDA-approved or one approved device available that's made by Cook Endoscopy. They call it the EchoTip Insight. I am not a paid consultant by them, and this is definitely not meant to be an advertisement for them, but it is the only one on the market. It's a good needle. It's built on the same platform as their other EUS needles, the same handle. You know, it virtually looks exactly like any other EUS needle they have, but it comes with the compact manometer, and it comes with the non-compressible tubing and the syringe that you need to do for heparinized saline, et cetera. Internationally, however, it's pretty interesting. A lot of third world countries don't have the device yet. And there's a friend of mine, he's actually a Twitter friend of mine. I have never met him, but hopefully I get to meet him at a DDW or maybe UEGW coming up. His name's Sahaj Rathi. He's a gastroenterologist and an advanced endoscopist at PGI Chandigarh in Punjab. And he's actually, you know, I think a little bit younger than me, but he's a very innovative guy. And he's been following some of the techniques that a lot of people in Asia do. And what they're actually doing is using the device that the IR folks use and hooking it up to any standard needle that they want to do it with. And his opinion is it's just as good. And the advantage of doing that is they actually get tracings. And a lot of hepatologists, specifically transplant hepatologists, or even transplant hepatology surgeons, really value those tracings as well. So if that's something that's in your practice, you can definitely look into it. I have no experience with it, so I will not recommend that you do it or not do it. I just want people to be aware that there are other alternatives outside of this needle. The cost of this needle is pretty expensive, actually. I don't recall exactly, and I should have researched this for the podcast, but hey, that's one thing I forgot now that I'm doing it. It's somewhere around $2,000, maybe a little bit less in terms of if you're talking about list price. And so you really want to make sure that you're doing it on the right patients and not, you know, that you're following all the proper steps so you don't waste it. The one key issue here is that there is not a code for it right now. And as with anything that's new in interventional endoscopy, codes take 2 to 4 years to come for those procedures. I mean, I think we're just about to get an ESD code and POEM codes finally out. But yeah, these procedures have been around for a while. So what you have to do when you do this procedure is you're going to have to bill an EUS with a fine needle aspiration or fine needle biopsy. And then you're going to probably use an unlisted code. And you're going to ask, you know, your billers will teach you how to do this, but you're going to ask for a dollar amount from the insurer based off of what is existing out there. And currently the only existing procedure, which is similar, is IR hepatic venography, wedged or free, with hemodynamic evaluation, radiological interpretation, supervision. And that pays a Medicare hospital facility rate of roughly $1,400. So when your coders are doing this and you're doing it in your hospital, that's going to be the basis probably of what you're going to ask for, and then you're going to add on whatever else you do. So one of the really important things to do when you do a portal pressure measurement is to do a liver biopsy also. Because if you're going to be measuring the portal pressure and you're there and you've got a needle in the liver, why not take a liver biopsy as well? Confirm what you're suspecting. Look for other causes of hepatic disease. Look for how much fibrosis there is, et cetera, et cetera. I think we all know, if you're listening to this podcast, we all know the benefits and the importance of doing a liver biopsy in hepatic patients. But, you know, that will add a little bit. But of course, these are facility fees. And you have to remember that generally speaking, when you bill for one or a procedure, you get paid for that, or your hospital gets paid for that. But the second thing is that if you add another procedure on top, then you get half of the cheaper of the two procedures. So just random example, if a procedure costs, both procedures cost $100 each, or that's what you're supposed to bill, you'll get $150 because you did the second one. But it's, you know, again, you want to make sure you're doing things for the right reason, and you're doing it not just to generate money. Now, that is the facility fee. For you, for those of us who are in private practice, or those of us who are paid on RVU models, you really need to look into what the physician reimbursement is. And it probably won't be any more, maybe just slightly more than a regular EUS FNA. So this is not a procedure that you're going to quote unquote get rich off of. And obviously we shouldn't be doing procedures for that reason either, but it's just something to know. And again, the finances do matter. If a needle is costing $2,000 and it's only reimbursing $1,500, your ASC, hospital, surgical center, et cetera, is not going to be too happy with you after several of these. Of course, a one-off, they're not going to care, or they're not going to pay much attention to it. But when you start using a lot of expensive accessories, then your hospital will have a problem with it. And based off these numbers right now, this is not a procedure that you can do currently in an ASC. You probably wouldn't do it in most ASCs anyway, because if you're, again, looking at portal pressure or portal hypertension, most likely those patients are an ASC 3 plus or an ASC 4, right? And so, to my knowledge, most freestanding ambulatory surgical centers are going to deal with ASC 1, ASC 2, and some selected ASC 3 patients, but you're probably not going to be in somebody who is potentially going to have bleeding varices and whatnot. But it is a good thing to know, because, you know, as more competitors come out in the market and the needle gets more mature, the cost will come down. And it is something that potentially in the future, in the right patient, and I have to emphasize that phrase, in the correct patient, you can definitely do it in an ASC. It's a safe procedure to do there. It's quick to do there. But again, the cost is prohibitive as of right now. And it is a young procedure. It is, you know, relatively young in terms of all of our toolkits. I did my first one roughly a year ago. I've only done about 6 or 7 since then. I have some friends in town in Phoenix who've just done their first or second one recently. And I know the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix started doing it right around the time I did, maybe a little bit before me. So there's not a lot of people out there doing it. There's not a lot of experience, but as you get some more in there and the volume goes up, you'll definitely see more literature come out about it. And then, you'll see other manufacturers get in the game, maybe the Bostons and the Cooks, I mean, the Olympuses, the Microtechs, and the ConMeds of the world may want to get involved as well. And then when that happens, price will hopefully start to come down. So, you know, one of the other things is, how do you get a program started? It's going to require support from several different locations. The first and the foremost is your institution. I've found over the years that some institutions are better at adopting new technology than other ones are. And I found that some are more eager to do it. So some people are eager to do it and some people are better at doing it. So those are two distinct differences there. Also, you know, a lot of hospitals will slow roll new technologies by, you know, analyzing them to death. You know, what's the ROI and how many of these are going to do? What cases does this replace? And where else are we doing these in the hospital? So a lot of these questions are smart questions, but they're also used to slow roll release of technology because they just, honestly, healthcare is expensive these days. People don't want to spend the money. So anyway, that's a different rant for a different day, and I'll leave that one alone for right now. But you definitely, once you get your support from your institution to look into it, then you need to reach out to your reps and get trained. This is not a procedure that requires certification. Anybody who does EUS and definitely endohepatology can do this very safely, very easily, and very competently. But you do need to watch a lot of videos, try to look at different variants in the anatomy. That, you know, one of the things I noticed is, you know, the videos I watched, the middle hepatic vein looked one way, and in my patients, it looked similar, but it was a little nerve-wracking because it wasn't exactly the same. And we're always taught as interventionalists from day one, or at least I was taught 14 years ago, stay away from blood vessels, right? Now, we all know that as we've done hundreds and hundreds of affinase, that you've probably all poked a small vein or artery at times, and yeah, those needles are thin enough. It's just like poking an IV in the arm, and with the bleeding is not going to be that bad, except you obviously don't have the ability to tamponade it. And again, any bleeding is bad bleeding, but we've all poked tiny vessels without any major consequence. And this is the first time that we're actually purposely going into a vein. And so that's a little nerve-wracking when you first do them, or a little, it gives you pause at least. And if it doesn't give you pause the very first time you do it, you may want to look at what makes you tick, because you should have a slight amount of fear when you do these procedures. But I recommend any of the courses that Cook puts on. They do have in-person courses. Most of them are taught by Dr. Chang, who was one of the key developers of this procedure in the U.S., and or Dr. Sammartino, who's his partner there. Or you can do virtual courses, and you can easily learn a lot of this through videos. And because of the pandemic that we all experienced, a lot of these courses were actually, co-produced for online consumption. And that's very helpful, for all of us. As I mentioned earlier, I don't think there's any special certificate required for this. And there's tons of online materials. Just put EUS PPG in YouTube. And again, I'll put some links in the description of this for people. Some of the tips I have for this is, honestly, don't be shy about getting your reps involved. But also keep in mind, with it being such a new procedure, not all your reps are actually going to be well-trained in it either. And these are not cases that they're doing every day. These are not like your standard FNA, FNBs, ERCPs. The reps are actually looking for these cases as well. So they're learning as you're learning. But you have two people together. Definitely get all the information, get them to help you out, have them there. Also make sure your hospital is on board with you doing this, or your, HOPD or, inpatient ASC. The other thing you definitely want to do is, make sure that you do have surgical backup in case something goes wrong. Now, it's a 25 gauge, once again, it's highly unlikely something bad is going to happen during these procedures. But as with any new procedure, you just want to ounce of caution with everything. A little bit shorter podcast than I normally do. I think go up to 35 to 45 minutes, but I think that kind of summarizes everything I wanted to say about EUS PPG. In my personal opinion, it's a good procedure. It is something that everybody who has an interest in endoscopic ultrasound can do. If you've listened to some of the interviews I've done in the past, I have a strong feeling that over the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot of diversification of advanced endoscopy. We're not going to be trained anymore as advanced endoscopists. I think, those days are gone. In fact, you're going to see subspecialization. You're going to see people going into endobariatrics, endohepatology, advanced tissue resection, biliary interventions, etc. And I think there's going to be different tracks for training, and you're going to learn that. And I think that, in fact, it's even going to be more strange, is that you're going to have people who are general advanced endoscopists and people who are, advanced endoscopists. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to term it, but it's headed in that direction. So if you do have an interest in endohepatology, this is perfect for you. If you're somebody who like me, was liver trained and, you know, kind of misses doing the liver portion of my career, then, and yeah, because I've been doing intervention for so long, I haven't been able to do as much liver as I used to. I miss some of it. I don't miss a lot of it. But this is another way to kind of get your feedback into it. And I think there are a lot of interventionalists out there who follow the pathway that I did, where they did liver transplant / hepatology before general GI, or general GI liver and then advanced endoscopy. But there's several people out there, and this is right up your alley. You already know the transplant world. You already know the hepatology world. So if you're doing that, you should definitely look into doing these procedures. It's an important procedure. I think a lot of people are developing liver disease. We're in an obesity epidemic in the United States. There's a lot of NASH, or sorry, the new world, a new word, I think it's MASLD, M-A-S-L-D. There's a lot of obese people who are getting liver disease. We just got out of a pandemic where people were drinking wine at home because they had nothing else to do, or beer, or scotch, whiskey, whatever it is, and they drank more than they did. I can't tell you, I think, and I'd be interested in hearing some of the comments if other people have had this experience like me, but I feel like the number of pseudocysts that I've been draining over the last 2 years has increased quite a bit from when I was doing 4 or 5 years ago. Now, some of that might be awareness of, you know, the hospital doctors and the ER doctors and surgeons that this technology is available. But I just feel like more and more younger people are coming in with advanced liver disease because of drinking. And when you start talking to them, a bulk of it was during the pandemic. So again, it's something that has a role, has a place. It's something that we will be seeing a lot of liver disease. So doing this would be helpful. I encourage you guys to look at the videos that I'm going to link in the description down below. I'm also going to try to put some review article links there for people. And, you know, hopefully that'll be helpful to you. And as I always say, that I'm available on Twitter or LinkedIn to answer any questions. And if you reach out to me or DM me, and, you know, once we start talking, I'll be happy to share my personal cell phone number with you, et cetera. Finally, a couple more little announcements, you know, that I usually say at every podcast. You know, make sure you join your societies, ASGE, FIGHT, ACG, if you're an interventional endoscopist. But if you're going to go into endohepatology, looking at AASLD will be helpful too. And I think a lot of what we will be doing with this specific procedure will require some input from AASLD. And that actually reminds me of one more thing I want to say. I've actually experienced a little hesitancy by hepatologists in getting this done. I think they're very comfortable with the traditional transjugular gradient measurements. And I understand why. I mean, they're fantastic and it's working well for them. And why would you want to do that? But I think that's what separates interventionalists from some of the other subspecialties in not just GI, but medicine. You know, we're the tech geeks or the nerds. And, you know, we love new technology. We always want to try new things. We're always trying to push our boundaries and, you know, do more. Whereas, you know, in traditional medicine, people are doing a little bit less. And again, this is not meant to be denigrate anybody or anything like that. But when I was doing hepatology, more and more of my colleagues were pushing liver biopsies to radiology. Why? Because the risk, the reimbursement, the headache, et cetera, having to watch a patient for 4 hours after you did them, put them in the right lateral decubitus position, check frequent blood pressures. Nobody wanted to mess with that. And physician reimbursement was like $50 or $60 for that, I mean, at that time. So, I mean, if you start looking at the economics of it, no one really cared. But I think interventionalists are looking at different ways to bring things back into GI. Another example, but unrelated, is PEG tubes. You know, a lot of people are pushing their PEG tubes to IR, but a lot of advanced endoscopists are wanting to do their own. So I think, you know, getting buy-in from your local hepatologists is going to be helpful, but, you know, having ASLD look into it as well. I've actually faced a lot of resistance from local hepatologists about liver biopsy as well. They want to do the 16-gauge percutaneous, which, again, is within their rights, especially if they're the ones managing the patient. But I feel like we get really good tissue with our 19-gauge liver biopsy. So importance of this, again, you know, being able to be a one-stop shop for liver disease management and bringing it back into the GI world. My final recommendation, obviously, and I say this at the end of every podcast, so if you're struggling with mental health, please reach out. Again, I'm always available on LinkedIn and Twitter. I feel like I spend too much time on those two websites, but I'm there. And, you know, if you are someone listening to this and you've been having bad or dark thoughts, reach out. And if it's not me, somebody else, you know, and no judgment. We're all there for one another. It's a small community. We need to help each other out. And, yeah, I just, once again, thank you for everybody listening to this podcast. If you do enjoy it, please subscribe or at least put a like on whichever platform you're listening to it on. And one cool little thing coming up, I'm currently working on it. It's going to take a little while because, you know, between being an interventionalist, a podcaster, and I make YouTube videos as well, and a soccer dad and a basketball dad, I'm trying to find some time to build a website, a proper website for this podcast. There is one that I'm using right now. It's on www.die.podbean.com, and it'll be in the links, but we're going to have our own website called The Interventional Endoscopist, and that should be coming hopefully in the next couple weeks, but we'll see. Time is of the essence. Once again, thank you everybody for listening. I hope you found some of the information useful here, and I look forward to getting a discussion started on this. So thank you so much, and everyone stay safe.